leading a two-day retreat here starting tomorrow, Saturday and Sunday. You're welcome to come to that if you like. I think you can come to one or both days. But any time I come to, some of you won't be there, so I have one night with you. I'm going to try to cram in a bunch of things. I'm just aware it's going to have a couple different elements in it. And then I also want to leave time to talk to you, like to hear from you. So that's ambitious to have all those. So I'm going to give a very, a talk that's a little bit in pieces, and then we'll dive a little, just because I want to fit more in. So I'm going to start with a story. About a month ago, maybe 2 months ago, my younger son, who's 3.5, was sick. Not seriously sick, but a bad cold. He had a little fever. It was a snotty situation. Uncomfortable little guy. And there was a lot of that this winter. And sometimes when he's really not feeling well, we don't judge me. Get out the computer. And there's this thing called Netflix. And there's, and if you're into Sesame Street or Bob the Builder or Curious George, there's like a gazillion episodes of those things. Probably all of you watch that in your spare time. So we try to, when he's healthy, not do much of that. If at all. And when he's sick, we also try to limit. Anyways. And he gets very excited about being sick. It's the problem. Every parenting decision you make causes another problem. Right? The problem is he loves being sick. So if anybody coughs or mentions the word sick, he'll start coughing. And then he'll say very innocently, "Can I watch something?" And that's his little phrase, "watch something." Right? Can I watch something? So he spent a morning, maybe an hour or two, watching something, a couple somethings, and he was very happy, It's that funny combination of, he looks just terrible, but he's like... and then we did other things in the afternoon. So then at night, my wife was laying down with him to put him to sleep. Turns out the light, they're laying there in the dark. And then she hears him say, "Hey, I'm still watching something." Cool, huh? I mean, problematic in some way. But he was aware. It's like, it's not gone. He's watching it. Whoa. There's a Dharma lesson in here. That's why I'm telling the story. What are you watching? I don't mean what are you watching on TV. But when you close your eyes at night, what are you watching? There's a lot going on in there. He was aware of watching it. And he's not like, I'm remembering. He's like, the images were there, and he was watching them. When you're laying in bed at night and you're scaring yourself about the future, are you watching it? Or is it just the future?
Sometimes.
Good. Great. It's not just when it's nighttime. It's true during the day. All day long, all the time, there are these little pictures popping up in your mind. Do you even notice it? Pictures that scare you, pictures that entice you. They're not just pictures, also there's words in there too. Telling you where to go, what to do, telling you what you think, telling you who you are, telling you who everybody else is, telling you the way the world is. So watching is, it should be hearing too, right? Are you watching it? Are you hearing it? This capacity to watch it is called citta nipassana in Theravada Buddhism, right? This is from the, it's one of the four foundations of mindfulness, this mindfulness of mind states. We're having these mind states all the time. And sometimes, you know, kids, it's also new for them that they notice stuff. You know, it's not like now he's doing citta nipassana all the time. Soon he'll be like the rest of us. but this is something we can practice. This thing of watching your mind is, I mean, I think it's one of the fundamental things that we're doing here. It is so powerful, it is so profound, and it can be so profoundly liberating. First, in my early part, when I first had my kind of moment that got me interested in meditating, you know, and I came from a family where people meditated, so when I had my moment of whatever that is, I kind of knew what to do, or I had an idea of what I might do. Yeah. And so I got very interested in watching my mind. And it's like I really saw that this is where. This is like where the whole thing was being formulated. My whole sense of the way things are, moment by moment. The whole sense of self, when we start to really see, inquire. The whole sense of what I am is formed by stories. You know, this limited sense of, oh, this is the kind of person I am, this is... Now these are, you know, some of them, you know, this conceptual framework that we live in so thickly, it just becomes reality. Even like I mentioned in this offhand way during the meditation about how there's only one breath that's ever happening. You know, I said, this is not a task you need to extend in time. You can't actually be present in the future. You can't be, you can only be present now because the future isn't anywhere. So awareness is real time. It's awareness is aware of what is, and the future is not. I'm sorry. It's not yet. So you don't know what it is, and it doesn't exist anywhere to be observed. The only place the future exists is as a bunch of images and ideas in your mind. So it's like you're dreaming the future. And yet we carry the future as this burden, right? Don't you feel it? Like you're all the things I have to do. Don't you feel that? And it's like, it's heavy. Sometimes it's really heavy. But where is it? Where are all those things you have to do? They're in here. You're dreaming them. In this moment, so we're carrying this. So this, even just this, you know, sometimes we don't see like how these conceptual frameworks that we have, which are very useful, like time, past, present, and future, we don't see how imprisoned we are by them experientially. It's not that, oh, the past is not the past, it doesn't exist. No. But it doesn't exist anywhere now. The past only exists as memory. That's the only place the past exists, the same with the future. It's not anywhere. You know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, all of this feels so real. And yet, where's Tuesday? You can't find it. Right? We carry this stuff. So this is just one aspect of how powerful the mind is in shaping. Yeah? And then there's, of course, the beliefs we're holding about who we are. You don't even notice how powerful and shaping they are. So I'm going to give some more simple examples. When I first started practicing, I got very interested in like the ways that I'm kind of programmed, for lack of a better word. And one of the things I noticed was that there was a lot of fear in this situation here. I'm sure I'm not alone. Actually, I know that now from having looked at so many people, but a lot of fear. And I got interested in watching how does the fear manifest? What's it come? And one of the things that I noticed, this was sort of the most easy, these examples are like easiest to notice. I was afraid of like being alone in the woods at night. So I started to take walks in the woods and to just watch my mind. And I got to see everything that was scary. Everything that was scaring me. It was interesting. There's a lot of different images in there. It's scary. And that the images alone don't have any power, but they give rise to really intense feelings. So I spent a fair amount of time just walking around in the woods at night. I'd feel fear, you know. Stop, and I would watch the images playing out, and I would feel the sensations in my body. Welcome them, breathe with them. And then I keep walking. It happened a lot. I'm not embarrassed to say. But it was humbling at the time. Like, whoa, I'm an adult. 20-something. I feel like an adult.
You are.
It's very interesting to notice how over time, you know, in doing this, not even that long, you know, these images start to lose their power. I stop believing them, right? Because they, well, nothing happened. And you picture somebody about to, you watch it, breathe, and then still here. I got to see, this is really happening in here, you know? And you might say, oh, you were in a safe place, it's not happening, but this is the Thai monks, you know, they used to do walking meditation on the tiger paths to work with fear. Yeah, walking back and forth. Where the tigers are known to go. Those guys are serious. I was doing this in like, you know, safe place. I was still scared. To practice with the fear that arises. So one thing is being aware of the mind. Very, very useful. How are you scaring yourself? What are you watching? You're just saying these little things so that you remember them. How are you, you know, enticing yourself? And then there's the whole dimension of feelings in the body. Yeah? This is also, you know, could be either citta upasana too, because citta is like mind states could include emotions. They didn't use the word emotions back in the day. So this would be mind states. But it also is mindfulness of the body, which is the first foundation of mindfulness. Kaya upasana, awareness in the body. So it's like, because a lot of emotion manifests in the body, so practicing both of those in the walking, you know, then. So I'm talking about all these things, not so that you know, it's not anything new. I'm trying to entice you to do it. That's what I'm trying to do. I'll be explicit. I'm trying to entice you into, now, if you get into watching your mind, but you haven't cultivated any stability of mind, it'll make you neurotic. You know, it'll make you obsessive. Like, did I think that? How did I think that? I'm thinking about so-and-so. How come? This is why this first part of the meditative practice is so important, cultivating stability. It's sometimes called samatha or shamatha. Collectedness of attention, unification of mind. This is a big part of the training. We're learning how to be present in a stable way. Right? Our awareness, it's not really our awareness, but our attention is often very scattered, right? It's stretched out among the future and the past and thinking about all these different things. We're very caught up in here. Very caught up. And so when we're present, it doesn't have much stability. We're present for a second, and then we're caught up again. Right? So the kind of presence I'm talking about, unless you're 3.5, watching your mind. Well, he wasn't watching his mind with any kind of sustained capacity, I don't think. It requires some cultivation for most of us. Maybe for some it doesn't. For me, it certainly has. And so the cultivation part of it, the way we cultivate stability of presence is by being present for a moment. And then doing it again and again and again and again and again. That's what we do with the breathing, the body. Right? You sit here, you're quiet, no distractions, right? And it's just, is it a jungle in there? Is it wild? Is it just me? Is it totally off? Does it go? Is it unruly? We practice coming back to just breathing in, feeling it, just breathing out. You go off again, practice coming back, just for one moment. As we do this again and again, something starts to happen. It just happens from training. Our minds are actually quite malleable. We're training them all the time by everything we do. But this is another kind of training, just to be here for a moment. And these very modest moments start to develop a momentum to them. They start to connect in a way. And this develops, and it can start to feel like present. And you realize I'm using time language for a few moments here. Yeah, they start to connect, and it just starts to be much more stable, the presence and awareness. Over time. Doesn't mean you don't get caught up, but the percentages start to shift from being like totally lost up here, you know, and then you need like, it's like a joke for me that like, this is how we get samadhi. Right? It's like, I'm all caught up in my mind, I'm going to put my mind on something stable. That's what we're doing. You're putting your mind on something that's more stable than this. It holds your attention. And then you can get a little bit of relief. Cell phone samadhi. Actually, I've never said that before. I just coined that term. It's a historical moment. Cell phone samadhi. So, we practice cell phone samadhi because we don't have real samadhi. You know, which is just the capacity to be stable in awareness. And this it does require practice. But it's not just meditating. You practice it like we're doing, right? Just being present in what you're actually doing. You're washing the dishes. This is not, you know, you've all heard this before. You're doing the dishes and being present. You know, you're chasing your kid around the house and you'd be present chasing your kid around the house. You're cleaning up the whatever mess that you'd be present in that. You're frustrated while you're cleaning it up. Be present in being frustrated. It's not like present is the opposite of human. Present with. That's the way we cultivate this kind of stability. And as many of you know, because you've been practicing, the degrees to which stability is possible can be quite striking. And sometimes we see this in retreat. For sometimes for people, that's where they get a real hit of, whoa. Well, it's like when the attention, the presence and awareness, or the let's call it presence, because presence has awareness as part of it. When it is stable, he's really saying it doesn't matter what's happening, outside or inside. The mind can be all over the place, and yet the awareness is not moving. It's stable. And it feels like where you're abiding is in the stability, not in all the motion. Even when your mind is doing a bunch of things. A little bit like a waterfall. You know, you see a waterfall. Usually we're just in the waterfall, cascading over the falls again and again. You know, sometimes behind a waterfall there's a little like hollowed out area. And you climb behind there and just sit and just watch the water. Right? You're not abiding in the change that's happening up here. This is shamatha. This is samadhi. That's stability of mind. And awareness, right? So this kind of practice, insight meditation, is traditionally called shamatha vipassana or samatha vipassana, because it's the stability that allows us to really watch the mind. It's very hard to study anything if you can't pay attention to it in a sustained way. I'm trying to imagine a scientist trying to do an experiment, but every 2 seconds, you know, their teenager's texting them, they're like, you can't observe anything in a sustained way. I have a teenager too, so that's fine. Can I stay out one more hour? One more? Some of you are doing that, you're saying, how can he have spent most of his 20s meditating and have a teenager? It's because I have a stepson. That's fine. I get the best of both worlds. I got to spend my 20s meditating while my wife is raising children and one child, and then I'm just joking. This stability part is important. And it's very cultivatable. It's not like, oh, I got to spend 20 years cultivating and then I can watch my mind. No. Just a little goes a long way. We are so ruled by what's happening up here most of the time that even a little bit of it, it makes a difference. And I think that's why the Buddha could say the Dharma is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. Even in the beginning, a little bit of the shift out of just being totally up here, it's like a big degree of freedom. So I wanted to talk about watching the mind. You don't even have to meditate to do this. Just sit there and watch people go by on the street. Just watch all the judgments that come up in your mind. Yeah. You're having them, even you Buddhists. So watch them. This is very useful. I wish more people watch their own judgments and biases. Right? We all do, because the world would be a safer, better, more compassionate place if we knew how judgmental we were. When you can see what your mind is doing, you don't have to believe it. Yeah? It's like, my mind's telling me stuff all day long that's not true. The times I'm in trouble is if I believe that stuff. Sometimes there's something very wise and powerful that comes up from here. And if I'm not present, I don't know the difference. There's no choicefulness. You know? It's like, oh, yeah, let's follow that one. Or, you know what? Who said that? So just you do people watching. You know, or just sit there and close your eyes and just watch what happens in your own mind. You can do that too. Once there's some stability. Another way to get stability is to just be interested. Interest is kind of quality of curious, investigative interest is one of the, in the Buddhist teachings. I don't know, as a Buddhist group, so I don't want to say all these Buddhist things. One of the factors of enlightenment, factors of awakening, okay, is interest in investigation. So it's investigation of states is what it's sometimes called. Just the interest in what your mind is doing can be enough to let there be stability, enough stability to sustain attention and watch what your mind is doing. So many, I'm just going to cut to the chase in terms of the story of you. So many of us carry beliefs that shape our sense of identity that we don't even recognize as thought created. That pervasive sense that something is wrong with you, that you just, it just feels true, that is a belief that you're carrying. You can't see the thought. And when we don't see a thought, it shapes the feeling of what is. Like the time thing. That's how powerful thought is. You know, I'm making it sound like, oh, you have thoughts, you watch them, and no big deal. They shape the world. Remember, that's also a line from the Buddha, from Dhammapada. We think it's the Buddha, right? How do we know? I just like to undermine what I'm saying. With our thoughts, we make the world. So, or that sense that something's broken in you, that's a belief. It takes some looking sometimes to see it. Yeah? But you can watch it happen moment by moment. You feel great. You're like, you're not even aware of it. You're feeling great. And then somebody kind of you say something and somebody kind of doesn't pay attention to it, and you just feel terrible. There's a bunch of thoughts happening in there, right? Oh, I'm so stupid or whatever. You don't even notice them. They happen so fast. You're not watching them. And it just shapes things, right? That's why it feels so intense. Thought is like that's amazing. Has tremendous power to shape experience. And being on retreat sometimes or doing a couple days of practice like we'll be doing this weekend is a great opportunity to just, I mean, even if you're not meditating well, which who is actually, right? It's like you don't have to be doing it well. Just putting yourself in that space, you can't help but notice a lot of what your mind is doing. You can't get away from it because you don't have this. And that's the function that retreat has had for millennia. Before there was this, there was other things calling attention. So retreat is a kind of protected environment where you get to practice being present, just in whatever you're doing, again and again. There's nothing else to do. You come back. And then you get to watch the mind shape your experience moment by moment. You're meditating, you think this is going well, and then you feel terrific, feel a little bit uncomfortable, and then you think, actually, I really have missed the whole day, and I haven't been mindful at all, and I don't know what I'm doing here, and then you feel terrible, and you think, I better go check out what the Tibetans are doing, or maybe I'll just go and go to Wall Street or something. Moment by moment, your thoughts are shaping your experience. Check it out. And don't neglect the cultivation of presence and awareness, this real-time awareness. It's not just being present, because my 3.5-year-old is present. But I wouldn't say he has mindfulness. Mostly, except that moment when he was watching Bob the Builder in his mind. Right? It's not just being present. It's being present. 3-year-olds are just totally uncivilized. I'm so glad they're small. Because they'd be so dangerous if they were big. It's like, it's being present, being able to be aware. This is something that Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's this great scholar, calls it lucid. He translates mindfulness. It's my favorite translation. Lucid, he translates sati, which is the word they always translate mindfulness. Lucid awareness. You've probably heard that. Lucid awareness with what's happening in the body, kaya vipassana, in the mind, citta vipassana, in the domain of pleasant and unpleasant feeling tones, which is something I will maybe talk more about this weekend. Another thing that we're really reacting to. It's a short sketch of the territory. You've heard this, maybe practice. I kind of invite you to don't think you're all. I would say it's sort of double edged to say this because I don't want to. It's not don't think you're. Don't think you've already seen it all. Don't think you already know. That's like a disease of advanced meditators. I've seen it all. Oh, I've been on retreat before. Every moment is new. You've seen a lot. But keep watching. Not because the content matters so much. It's like after a while, you kind of have seen it all. You've seen all the stories your mind churns out, and you know what? They're not that interesting. That's one of the great rude awakenings of meditation. That brilliant person you thought you are. But 90% of the time, you just caught up and thinking the same thing you thought yesterday. And it's amazing that it seems so fresh and new all the time to us. Because, man, is it boring. That's why we're always trying to get away from ourselves. Right? That's why it's like, give me some samadhi that's out here. Right? Because it's like, oh, it's deathly boring. That I would call that divine boredom. You get so bored by that you don't believe it anymore. And it's incredible the degrees of spaciousness. the degree of spaciousness that's available when you're not locked in our thought-created bubble about what the world is and who we are. Let's stop there with my spiel, and maybe we could dialogue a little bit about this, and then maybe I'll say some more stuff later if I get inspired. But I'm interested, actually, in what's happening for you in practicing, or what does what I'm saying give rise to in you? I'm less interested in kind of like just theoretical abstract questions, and more in like where the rubber meets the road of your own investigation, your own practice. I think, okay, I can't even stop myself from talking here. I think nowadays it's like the thing, there's so much Dharma available, maybe more in terms of teaching and stuff available to read, maybe more than ever in history, which is incredible. It's amazing. You can go, I talked to my dad, it's like they used to have to go to some bookstore and it was like the secret thing, and then they had like one copy of something and they were just like, wow. But now you go into a bookstore, it's even harder to find something because there's so much, right? But you could read endlessly. And I think the thing that I really want to encourage now is reading is great, but let's walk the path. And the path is here. The path is your life right now, always. When you're aware, when you have lucid awareness with you, the path, your life as it is the path of the Buddha. Right? That's where liberation comes out of this awareness and learning of the nature of experience. Learning how we, seeing how we imprison ourselves, what we're imprisoned by, seeing what leads to happiness, what leads to suffering in our own experience. And seeing where the end of that is liberation here and now. So I'm encouraging you, this is a piece that I think in a modern time, this isn't just like a side thing. Let it, it can be concurrent with your life. Yeah? And let it be. There's this Tai Chi teacher in the Bay Area who's very old now, he's not teaching, but his students made a shirt for him out of one of his sayings. It's my favorite saying. One of my favorite sayings, period, but my favorite saying is, he was from Taiwan, so it's in accented English. On the front it says, you know it, and on the back it says, why you not do it? So I'll just repeat it, just in case. Do we have a mic that can go around or no?
No.
No, okay. I'll do my best to repeat the question. He was saying that in his practice, there can be, he's describing a particular place that can arise, or a state that can arise, where there's awareness and a good amount of stability, but it feels dry, like a desert. And there's watching, you can see thoughts, but sort of, boring, right? You didn't see that word, but yeah, boring. And just like not, it's not that kind of sweet stillness that also could have the same watching, maybe even some of the same content. So the question was, is it just something to be with, and or is there any other? I'll say a few things because I always feel like my friend Vinny back in the Bay, he has this line which he says, which I really like, he always says, we're comparing hallucinations. I feel like whenever we're talking about mind states and stuff, we're always comparing hallucinations. So I'll just say a few things, and I don't know if they apply to what you're talking about, but I'll, you know, so I think sometimes it can just, there are periods of practice where it is just like a desert, and it's sort of like, sometimes I think about it as like, you know, in any of those mythological journeys, or in like the Lord of the Rings, you know, they go through, you go through swamps, you go through bogs, you go through deserts, you go through mountains, you know. Sometimes you come out to like a beautiful spot, and then you go into some, so sometimes it's that kind of thing where it's just continue, you know. And other times, this is a little harder to talk about, but sometimes I think there's this whole other dimension that doesn't get talked about that much in meditative practice, at least in this tradition of like, kind of like the energetic aspect. And I say energetic, I mean kind of like, what's their, you know, when they talk about chi or prana. And sometimes I think there can be states where things get kind of dry, whether you say it in the mind or in the system. I don't know if this makes any sense. But sometimes sometimes in my practice, I get to dry places and I kind of need to just change it up a little. You know, where it's like I need to get it a little more, I need to be a little more juicy in my attitude. And sometimes that's, you know, sometimes that's paying less attention, actually. Sometimes if there's more awareness and a little less of the juicy part of samadhi, this is getting, it gets brittle. And then everything has that quality. So sometimes I think, how do I make it juicier? And sometimes if I pay less attention, I lower the awareness part, and I kind of get in the more swimmy aspect of it. Sometimes that'll bring a little juice back in, or, you know, with emotions, rather than observing them, I like feel them, you know? So sometimes there's a little bit of that. Even the thing of watching, even though I use that as the whole metaphor, sometimes that's really the wrong thing to do. This is the great thing about Dharma teaching, is that everything you're saying is wrong a fair amount of the time. You know, it's like, I could give the opposite talk and it would be equally true. Like, so watching, so now I'm going to counter everything I just said. So watching, the problem with that is like sometimes we become these a little bit like removed. So sometimes with being with emotions and feelings, it's actually more useful, you're still watching, it's sort of different. Like, rather than thinking, and this is a language thing, mindful of them, I like to shift the language and say mindful in them. You know, what's it like to be mindful in the anger? Oh, that feels a lot more than it is. Or mindful in sadness, like you're grieving when you're like in it. And mindfulness, awareness can be present in that. It's not like you're on the hill with binoculars. So I'm just, I don't know, sometimes for me that leaning in a little bit, just kind of like getting a little more dirty, that sometimes that way. So anyway, those are a few things, and I'm not sure what's happening. Okay. Oh yeah,
I'm glad you talk about fear and mindfulness. And my question is it ever skillful to turn away? Like if you can't, like it's too much.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought it up. Absolutely. Again, the spirit of everything I say is wrong. Often the reason I'm talking about something is because it's like something we don't do much of. So I'm like hitting the side of, we don't often be with anything in our society. So I'm really hitting hard the part about being with it. But what you're saying is really important because we're learning, in other words, we're learning how to be with our own experience. And we need to be gentle in that and not abusive towards ourselves. And only you can know the difference, you know, when sitting with physical pain goes from being like useful dharmic exploration to kind of some kind of self-punishment thing, you know, like seeking virtue through whatever. There's a long history of that, you know. And similarly with fear or any state, you know, it's, yeah, be with them a little and then turn your attention to something else, go back to the breathing. Again, it's about how to skillfully be with it. In doing that, first of all, one interesting thing is it'll give you the confidence. It's like being able to not be with it can give you the confidence to be with it. Right? You know, like, if it gets too much, I can take a break. That can help. That can help. You know? So with all these things, yeah, listen to yourself around and just don't just be automatically about like, oh, I can't be with this. Play the edge a little bit, but listen to yourself around that, you know? You'll have another opportunity. It's not like, I missed the fear, that'll never arise again. Would that it were that way, right? But no, it's not that. So, yeah, that's great. And that's true around anything, you know? Sort of like, you know, whether it's grief or it's some state that you experience, you're just like, you know what? I've stayed away from that my whole life. I'm starting to be aware of it. I can kind of check it out from like a mile away. So keep it a mile away and just look at it for a little while. Maybe get a little close, put your toe in it. You know, I'm mixing metaphors all the time. If it's a lake or it's whatever, put your toe in it, put your foot in it. Yeah, yeah. That's important. Yeah, another way it's sort of like it's just this great irony that we have, you've lived with yourself your whole life, and yet when we bring a certain kind of meditative awareness to what's happening, it's like this is a totally uncharted territory. You know, it's like how can those two things be true simultaneously, and yet they kind of are. You know, and so we have to be. You don't get to know anything all at once. Like if you sat down, sometimes it's useful to think of these things relationally. Like say you want to get to know another person, you don't sit down and be like, tell me everything about yourself. Like, what's your fear like? What's your fear? You know, you don't fear. That makes people clam up. You know, if you do that to yourself, you'll clam up too. You know, so you gotta take your time. It takes time to get to know somebody, you included. You know, you have to have the right conditions. It has to be gentle, there has to be some friendliness. All of this is true of being with any of your things, you know. Sometimes, especially with men, they say, like, I can't be aware of my emotions. Every time I turn to look at it, it goes away. You know? And I say, it's because of how you're looking at it. You know, I know this one firsthand, too. So I'm just not like you guys. Because I remember when I first started looking at things, I was looking at them like this. And that's pretty aggressive. And sometimes, you know, our inner states are a little bit like wild animals, you know, or like children. You know, wild animals don't like it when you're like, you know, you have to kind of hang out, not even look at them too directly sometimes, you know? So, okay, you know, like I actually have a friend who doesn't have kids and doesn't have great instincts. And he'll go up to my younger son and be like, that scares the shit out of me. You know, he's just trying to connect, but it's like, well, think of the size difference. So we'll do that to ourselves. Be gentle. And, you know, it's this double-edged thing, again, of like not being in a rush, but not just putting it off. You know, Suzuki Roshi, you know, a great teacher from San Francisco, not from San Francisco, but that was very, you know, he abided. He had this beautiful word, constancy. Yeah, this kind of, to have this kind of constancy where we're not, you know, just saying, oh, let's go back to awareness, but we're not pushing in some kind of way that makes being present feel like a burden or this task. I mean, that would really kill the practice, right? Who would want to do it? 24 hours now to be present for. That's another thing to do. You know? Actually, another 24 hours full of stuff to do. You know, but presence, awareness is sort of what makes everything more alive. So just to get into the juicy part of it, it's like, rather than having that in order to mind, believe me, there'll be plenty of effects from this. You don't even have to worry about it. You know, but if you're in that effect-based mind, right, I'll do this in order to, it'll make this a very long journey. If you can let go of that kind of in order to mode and just let this be fresh, it makes the difficult stuff easier because you're present for it. It doesn't make it easy or enjoyable, but it makes it more bearable in a way, even though you might feel it more, and it makes the beautiful stuff a lot richer because you're actually present for it. But, yeah, so it's that an interesting balance and effort of keeping the constancy, but not making it this burden, this thing, oh, I gotta do it, I gotta meditate, I gotta be present. I've caught myself saying that many times. I gotta be present. And if I ever hear the tone, like, that sounds, doesn't sound fun. Anybody else? Please.
I work as a music teacher, and I find it so useful to use metaphors to convey things about the essence of new experiences. So I'm wondering if you could share with us any useful metaphors you might have for what it's like to be in the zone.
In the zone. Which zone are you referring to?
I mean, it's a great mystery, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I very much appreciate your spirit of playfulness with the work.
Yeah.
And I like that. But maybe, and you also used the word enticing, so maybe you can entice us to what it is to be in an optimal state.
Okay. It's a great question. One thing that's interesting and paradoxical about this kind of practice, and it's actually so radical that it's almost hard to convey because of how different it is than the way we usually think about things. What we're cultivating in this is not a state. Lots of states come and go. That's why I was kind of half joking when I said, what zone are you talking about? You know, there's like a, unless you come to science, it almost says like worker zone, or there's a zillion zones. I know what you are, you know, I'm being playful, but also, so what we're learning how to do is be present. To be present right now in a stable way and present with what's happening. So in the formal meditation, we're present, and we're present with the breathing in the beginning. And then as we'll do in the next couple days in the retreat, the expanding the instructions to be with also being with the sensations in our body, being with the feelings and emotions that arise, being with the states of mind that come and go. All the various states of mind. You feel excited, you feel sad, you feel tired, you feel present, you feel cloudy, you feel foggy, all the various weather patterns that can come through the mind. What we practice is being stably present with this incredible range of experience, which is really the reign, it's the territory of being human. This will, when we're present in this way, yeah, we may have warm moments just from the being present part, where there's that kind of, you know, spontaneity or sense of flow. That does happen from being present too. That's more of a samadhi factor, I think. Sort of like, yeah, it's like more present. We're less in our rigid part of our mind, to talk about music, right? Less in that already traversed territory. When we're less in that territory, there's a vast domain of creative stuff that comes, right? Like, I can never plan the things I say because I can't plan it as well as it comes out when I'm not trying to do it. Right? The stuff's in there, the knowledge comes, I can't, when I'm me, I can't write it out like that. It's just a different mode. So yeah, you may have more, that may be more available, right? Because we're less locked in. And yet, that's not the goal. It's sort of like a nice side effect. But what we're practicing is the steady presence that can be with the full range of experience. The reason this is so different is because then our freedom here and now is not dependent on the conditions. That's what's so radical. It's hard to even think about. It's a stillness that's not dependent on it even being still in here. And sometimes we experience this where it's like the mind is extremely busy. It's very chaotic, or it's moving very rapidly, but there's stillness through it. The mind is not moving, even though the content is moving. And this is a lot like a flow state where you feel like everything's moving slowly, but it's not. You know, it's going to come through. So when we're in the domain of awareness, it transcends opposites. It just transcends, like, for example, we usually think of, I'm sleepy. But you can be very aware of a state of sleepiness. And you notice that the awareness is not sleepy, but the state of sleepiness is still present. This is very liberating. You can watch yourself fall asleep. Then who's sleeping? You are. And who's awake? That's the real question. Right? And so that's a great question you're asking, because it gets at what makes this so different. So the training then is it's very different than a lot of others, because it's not about making something else happen. It's about, can I practice being here right now with what is actually happening? And a lot of that's hard, it's difficult for, you know, it's like we don't know how to be with it. You know, I feel restless, how do I be with restlessness? So we practice it, it's sort of like, oh, just restless, feeling restless. And what we start to notice is it's the struggle with the state that creates the mental suffering. When restlessness can just be restless, there's actually no one who's restless. There's just restlessness. And it can be totally okay, as weird as that sounds. Restlessness can be totally okay. Just like when you're really quiet, and you might notice sometimes breathing is breathing. It's not like I'm breathing. It only feels like I'm breathing when I'm thinking. There's some kind of mental part where I'm adding the sense of, like, I'm breathing. The body's breathing. You know? The body, you know, nature's smarter than you. Nature's not going to leave breathing up to you. Right? You cannot be trusted with anything important that's happening. All the important things are not subject to your control, because look, you can't even pay attention for 5 seconds. You'd be in charge of breathing, you'd be dead. So, you know, just joking. But I think it's, do you get the sense of what I'm saying? I can tell you do. Yeah, so the practice is, that's why it's so paradoxical. It's about being with what is here now. That is where the great change comes from. And as, you know, one of my friends and fellow teachers, Trudy Goodman, who, she was a student of my dad's teacher, Sansanin, he's this Korean Zen teacher in the Boston area. And she was with him from when she was young. He was young. And he used to say to them, she told the story, he used to say to them, if you practice long enough, you will get everything. she was young, she says, she thought, oh, wow, like, we'll get everything. And she said, as things went on, she realized, he meant everything. Right? This is this thing of like being with the whole range of human experience, with the mind being able to be still, be okay in it. Right? All the stuff that scares us. So that's the path. And it's not, you know, it's a serious business. It's not like you don't do that on a weekend. But you can do a lot on a weekend. You know, I said to one student once, I made an offhand comment at my weekly group in Berkeley. I said, we spend a lot of time trying to avoid what we're actually feeling. It's just some offhanded moment. And then the next week, this woman came back and she said, you know, I heard what you said. Occasionally this happens, it's very cool. So I just went home, I spent the whole weekend in my apartment just being with what was actually happening, with what I was actually feeling. She said, and you know what? It was amazing. So I realized all of these things that I'm avoiding all the time, you know what? They're not that bad. It's cool. So thank you for that. Let's see, yeah, let's go here and here.
You were talking about the anger.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm watching the anger, it kind of stops halfway through.
It stops halfway through, yeah.
But I can still feel in the body's reaction.
Mm-hmm.
The burning sensation, and the body must be generating some kind of a chemical.
Yes.
But there's a disconnect between body and mind. Because if mind knew that it's damaging the body, it still gets in.
The mind, wait, say that last part again.
There's a disconnect between the body's mm-hmm. reaction and the mind.
Because the mind has stopped generating the content, but it's still happening in the body.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so with emotions, most of them, some of them are pure, they don't have thoughts, but often there's a mix of thinking and feeling happening. There's think thoughts that happen, and then there's all this happening in the body. Right? So the key in being learning how to be present with these things is to be with both. Right? Sometimes if you do just, you know, if the story is very, often the story is fueling the emotion, but then what will happen is the emotion will fuel the story, so it's this nice feedback loop, right? You think, like, somebody does something, and you think, like, how could they do that? And then you feel like, oh. And then you forget about that, but you're just like, oh. And then you start thinking, like, man, how come so-and-so said that? You know, sort of like, sometimes it just goes and finds other stuff to be mad about. And it's this wonderful thing. Like, it's actually quite amazing. You could stay mad for a long time like that. But we succeed at that all the time. And then every time you have the thought, it starts all over again. It's sort of like, just like it's new, you know? Again, the amazing problem. But sometimes the thing is to shift the attention away from the thinking and just be with the feeling in the body, you know? And to like make more space for it, as weird as it sounds. Because sometimes I think all of these states, these like emotional states, they're energies, right? And so we kind of have to learn how to work with the energy of the state. So anger has this kind of energy, yeah? And so you need to, like, learn how to make your... This is sort of the energetic dimension of it. How do you embrace that energy? Make room for it in your body. Because when you don't make room for it, you explode. It's like there's not enough room in the system, and that's where the explosion happens. And you can check that out. Somebody's saying something that's really irritating to you, and you're like, I'm just not going to say anything. I'm just not going to say anything. But they keep talking. What happens? You resist it for a while until it builds up, and then you can't hold it anymore. So then you're like, you're a jerk. And then you feel better. And now they're feeling worse. What you did was you let the energy out. So it's not that that's wrong. We want to figure out what to do with the energy, but there could be more skillful ways of working with the energy. So on that dimension, can you make room for the anger? You could sometimes let it be bigger than your body. Say, oh, it's filling my body. Can I let it fill the whole room? I'm acting it out right now. So I'm like, oh, can I let it fill the whole room? Because the psyche awareness is that big. Can I let it fill the whole sky? Oh, so now that energy has a lot more space. It's not like you're just making your mind bigger. Actually, no. Your mind is infinitely big. You're just acknowledging that there's that much space. Say, oh, let it fill the whole universe. Can you feel that as I'm talking about it? There's so much more room for that energy, and that can let it quiet down. Yeah. But you let it quiet down by letting it be big. That's the paradoxical part. Is this making sense? Yeah, so I think sometimes we are working with the somatic part of it a lot. And sometimes that's not what we're not that good at. I'll just say one more thing. The true meaning of Tantra is about transforming those energies. Right? Everybody thinks Tantra is about sex, but it's not really. It's about transforming these energies. And what we can notice, and you may notice this at times, is that the anger has a lot of energy in it. And that energy can be used. When we're not reactive around anger, anger transforms into a kind of discriminating clarity. The energy is available. It's very interesting. Energy is available and there's clear seeing. Usually with anger, there's not clear seeing. It's the opposite. Just like, and a lot of these emotional states have these kind of, that we think of as bad, or not, but they have this kind of other side to them when we can work with the energy. And I invite you into that as an exploration. I think it's very interesting territory. Yeah, and so to feel in your body and then to watch the mind come in again. Cool. Does that speak to what you're... Thank you. Maybe one... Yeah, we have one time for one more. Yeah.
I think we all ruminate on certain things, but oftentimes we have certain stories that just play over and over.
Yeah, your favorite ones. Yeah. Your least favorite ones.
Yeah. And they're difficult. So yeah. How do we skillfully stay in awareness of a particular story, yet not re-invite it for rumination? And if once we're aware, how do we go back and maybe retell that story or just be with it where it's not so painful? So if it inevitably does come up, it's there without finding these moments.
I don't want to ask you to reveal more than you're comfortable with. Can you say anything about what kinds of stories you're talking about, or like
a visual past?
But are they about important things, or are they kind of like?
Well, just hear the same occurring thing.
Same occurring thing, and there's a story about it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, we all have our, if you're watching your mind, you notice you have your top five or your top 10 places you go. You know? Sometimes I think of them as like well-worn grooves in the mind. It's like the wagon wheel ran deep there, and so everything just like goes into that groove. It's like anything that's like in the neighborhood just kind of like goes right in there. It's like, here I am thinking the same thing again. You know? And it's an interesting way how sometimes that creates the repetitive aspect of our life. It's like, why does the same thing keep happening? Sometimes it's because it's kind of like, I don't know, because the grooves are kind of, keep going in the groove, you know? So sometimes, again, to contradict what I said before, sometimes when you know the story really well and you've watched it a lot, you can just see it and be like, all right, I don't need to get on that roller coaster ride. Yeah, I've been on it so many times. And you can just shift your attention to something else. But often, this is why the insight part is so important. If a thought has charge like that, we still believe it. You know? When we don't believe it, it has no power. That's how you know. You ever think, I don't believe that anymore. See, does it have any power to affect your body? If it does, you still believe it. You know, even if intellectually you don't think you do it. You know, so there's no right way to approach it, but I think sometimes inquiring into that story can be useful too. So like, is it true? Sometimes just that question can make some space and can start to say like, you know, all the places where it's not true. Because our stories are just these great simplifications of experience. You know, often so oversimplified that they're inaccurate. And so, yeah, sometimes a little inquiry like that can be useful. But also I'm a believer in ruthless observing sometimes for that stuff. Because sometimes I really think about it as like, we don't let ourselves really be in the story. Like, let yourself really be in the story with awareness. You know, not like, oh, I know this story already, but like, really be in it. And stay in it with awareness till the end. And if it pops up, do it again. I'm really going to be in it. Because to me, the metaphor that makes sense, just to use an analogy, is like you go to a movie, right? And you're really in the story of the movie. That's why we go to movies, because they capture us. But if you went to the same movie 100 times, boy, it would not capture you anymore, unless it was Casablanca. That would still do it for me. That's a good, there are some movies like that, you know? I don't know, maybe this is messing up my metaphor here, but I have to be honest about Casablanca. If you go 100 times and you really try to watch it, it gets boring. You know, it gets so predictable, you know everything that happens. And a story like that, it's the same story, so it's like always the same thing. You stop believing it from seeing it over and over again. You know, because also that kind of clear scene, it's like, and sometimes we have to do that with something. We have to go to the movie the 85th time, and it's excruciating, you know? And over time, it's like, literally, you stop noticing what's on the screen, and you start noticing who's in the theater. You know, it's like, there's got to be something else happening. You know? And before, you just kept going to the movie and thinking you'd never seen it before. Have you seen the one about the, you know? About the, anyway. Have you seen that one? I was trying to think of a good Casablanca reference. No, I haven't seen it. Let's go. Oh, yeah, I think I've seen this one before. Sometimes going again and again. Then you start noticing who's in the theater. You get bored. You start starting conversations with people. After a while, you see, you walk by the theater and you see the thing. And you're just like, I've really seen that one. I know the whole thing. So sometimes there's that element, and that's the hard work of meditation. It's just like, if this still is causing me pain, I still believe it. Yeah. And sometimes you can also do little other things, like look for contradictory evidence, because you'll find it. Yeah. Is this true? Question is very useful. Because often if you ask that with clarity about one of those stories, you see like, you know what, not really. Or very partially. And just to give you a little hint, almost none of the stories you tell yourself are true. If you really look at them, almost none. It's good to end on a dramatic note. So, we've come to the close of the evening.